Houston's Community Station.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's Community Station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. And that tells us that it is 5 p.m. Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, or kpft.org on the internet. I'm Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through the windows of their souls, on fanciful trips amid worlds of enchantment, before returning us safely to the present. My guest tonight is Jim Heinen, a poet, a writer, and someone that I would call a keeper of the oral storytelling tradition. He is a widely published author of several books of poems, novels, nonfiction, and perhaps his favorite genre, short stories, especially about the boys that were inspired by his early life in rural Iowa. I met Jim in 1977 when he was selected as a U.S. writer for the U.S.-UK Bicentennial Exchange Fellowship. He and his wife were living in Norwich, as was I, as a Marshall Scholar, another UK fellowship for graduate students from the US. So there we were, ready to experience UK life. Norwich is in County Norfolk on the North Sea. Jim, it's been a long time. Great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here, and you make me remember Norfolk and Norwich, England, where we were for that year. Did you learn the Norwich accent?
You know, I what's funny is there were a few words that I learned in Norwich that I did not know in English. So, for example, I had never used I'm trying to remember what the name is called. It's a thing that takes away the smells, the dangerous vapors when you're working in the lab. See, I don't know the name in English. I didn't work in a lab in the US. And in England, they call it a fume cupboard.
And of course.
They call it a fume cupboard.
Okay. That's great.
You know, and I get back to the US and it's like, what do I do with it? So go put it in the fume cupboard. And everybody's, what? Oh, that's right. That's what it's called in the US. So there were a few words, the fume cupboard. And then I remember changing trains in Peterborough to go to Cambridge. And you'd get on the train and the conductor would say, "Are you going to Peterborough today?"
That's great. I only came up with one phrase that I thought epitomized the Norwich accent. And it is simply, "You might say that. You might say that."
Oh, yeah. You might
you
say
might
that.
Say that. My daughter, who was just two and turned three while living there, she actually started to get a pretty good accent, but no, I was always spotted as an American by the sound.
I lived with an Irish woman, I think about the time I met you, and I picked up a little bit of her accent and dropped enough of my American accent that people recognized I wasn't from Norfolk and I wasn't from England. But they would say, are you from Ireland? You know, where are you from? You're from someplace, which, you know, an American in Norfolk at that time was not always well received.
True, true. But it helped to have kids.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
To walk around with a small child.
Oh, yeah.
It seems to bring in everybody's heart.
And your wife was pregnant at the time. And I mean, who can resist a pregnant
woman? Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. So I know I just skimmed the surface and we talked a little bit about when we met. But tell me a little bit more about yourself, how you got into writing.
Well, I grew up, so to speak, on a farm in Iowa, in one of the last areas of Iowa to get electricity, which meant that we kept our milk in the cellar to keep it cool overnight. And it meant that we had a kerosene lamp hanging in the kitchen for light at night. Yeah. And then when I was 7 years old, we got electricity and the whole world bloomed with light after that. But that's one part of my childhood. The other part is that the community was almost exclusively Dutch Calvinist, which meant all kinds of rules about proper behavior, no unnecessary work on Sunday, no theater attendance when I was a little boy. Of course, things have changed immensely since then, but they did leave a mark. You know, there's no way you can get away from that mark.
I remember you always telling me that you were raised as a Calvinist and that sometimes you could see yourself as a Calvinist preacher. And I thought, Jim Heinen, Calvinist preacher? Jim Heinen, Calvinist preacher?
You know, Calvinism is, of course, summarized in the Tulip Doctrine. You know the Tulip Doctrine, don't
no,
you?
No, I don't.
Well, the T stands for total depravity.
Okay.
Which is not utter depravity. If we were utterly depraved, we would be at each other's throats. So there would be nothing restraining us. But it's just total depravity, which is, you know, not utter depravity. U is for unconditional election, meaning you don't do anything yourself. And, you know, God does it all. L is for limited atonement, meaning that Jesus was thinking of just the elect, not everybody. And I, and this is the one I love, is irresistible grace. I sort of feel that from the universe. I feel that the world has been really good to me. And the P is for preservation of the saints, which all that means is once a believer, always a believer. There's no such thing as backsliding. Isn't that great stuff?
Yeah. St. Christopher gets to stay with y'all. Catholics really know. So you began first writing poetry, and I saw an interview that you had, and you really said something wonderful. You said that your stories, your short stories came out of your poems came out of your background. And I wondered if you could read a poem to us, and then a short story inspired by the poem or drawn out of the poem.
Okay, I've got one in which I actually wrote the same thing as a poem and as a story.
Okay,
should I do that?
Yes.
It's called The Great Strength. I'll read the poem first. Those who bulged from their shirts like straw from tightly tied bales, who won fistfights at the fair, caught the greased pig, rustled the steer, were strong men of the plains. But the great strength was private, known only to old farmers who could see the power hidden in the face of a peddler or farmhand, in the strangely shaped body, pinched shoulders and spreading hips, bent over like hybrid grain in the wind. When the fields had been cleared, when the last hay was stacked, the last fence fixed, when the cellar was sealed for winter, always there was the accident, and he would be there with jackknife or pliers or bare hands, his strength coming out from all its secret parts. For a moment we knew, a wagon set upright, a hand pulled free from moving gears. It was all in the wrists or the legs or the eyes. Afterwards, there was no excitement at all, and only a few saw him fade back to his body. There's the poem version. I wrote the same one as I guess the current language typically is flash fiction, short story.
Oh, yes.
Called The Great Strength. There were many strong men, ones who showed up at county fairs and wrestled a steer or went into the ring with the circus wrestler and threw him out in 10 seconds. There were men who came to the sales barn every Saturday and took bets on what they could lift, usually a young steer and one of the pens. Men who took on any two men in tug of war. Everyone knew who the strong men were and who to bet on. But then there was the man nobody noticed, who never tried showing off in front of people. He was the one with the great strength. How could you tell who had the great strength? You couldn't. Not until there was an accident. Then he'd be there like the one good spring that never goes dry in a dry year. Just when you needed him, he'd be there and not even smiling, just doing what had to be done, pulling a hand free from moving gears, lifting a wagon off somebody's leg, pulling a hog from a well, whatever had to be done. The boys saw the great strength once. Late August, when everything was quiet, all the oats harvested, all the straw stacked, farmers in town visiting. An old church was being torn down and people were standing around watching. The caterpillar was pushing big pieces out of its side. All of a sudden, the wind caught a piece of loose roof and lifted it off the church. It went wobbling through the air like a sick bird, then landed on one end and tipped over on a bunch of people. When all you could hear was everyone screaming, the roof started rising slowly, as if the wind had caught it again. It wasn't the wind. It was the great strength. In old overalls, lifting that big section of roof, all of those trapped people were crawling out, scratched and bleeding. Afterwards, everybody was looking out for the people who got hurt under the roof. And after a little while, no one knew for sure where the great strength had gone. He was like the wind in this way, too.
It's beautiful.
When you like best.
I picture it. You're so
interesting
in the moment that you don't even notice who's the rescue is so unexpected yet smooth that you don't even notice it. You know, you often read in the news, oh, all these people were rescued by someone, but they don't know who.
Right.
Trying to find their rescue.
There is the great strength.
Yes. He lives on. I think I read about him just the other day.
Yes. He's there when you need him. He'll be there.
Now that's a beautiful comparison of the poem to the short story. The short story goes a little further in weaving a story and adds a few more lyrical details, I think. So is it a strange experience to take the poem and make the story from it?
You know, I guess one learns something about form, like the form invites a certain a kind of language. When you're in prose, suddenly there can be a flow of the sentence that takes you where you didn't think it was going to go, whereas in the poem you're so attentive to the sound and where to stop and to make some significance out of the line break. I suspect right now I'm talking to other writers. But you know, I think people sort of understand and know when any of us is being the poet with very controlled, sharp language, and when we are being the prose writer, where we let the flow go and, you know, sort of the flow of the river of language.
That's a beautiful description. Now, you talk about how these poems were initially inspired by your life back home. Was there a strong man, a silent strong man?
Yes, I think it was my dad. But no, it would always be surprising. It really, where it showed was not in these circumstances of emergency. It showed in show-off times like tug-of-wars. And then you would be surprised, you know, this kind of bent old guy who is tug-of-warring with maybe three young guys. And he would have a strange shape, usually arms that were too long, you know, sort of a bent over, but all muscle. And then you'd see that great strength. And so my imagination just moves it away from a silly game at the county fair and put it in a real situation. You know, memory doesn't give me the story. It opens the door to the imagination. Memory is the gateway to imagine the story. So I can remember a scene, but to make something new happen there, that's entirely imagined.
That is wonderful. And I play
sometimes.
I play a little bit of flash fiction myself. So I'm going to remember that. Take the memory and then let the imagination take it. Now, looking at your books, and I've looked through, I knew you when you were more a poet than a novelist. And since then, you've written several books that harken back to, I think, your childhood. And one that caught my eye was, I think it's called Being the Youngest.
Being Youngest is a novel, a YA novel.
And it has Henry and Gretchen, who are Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, two kids who meet each other and have these adventures together.
So it just arrived in my mailbox today. And I have to say that it reminds me of a book that my father read as a little boy and then read to us. This was a tradition in the family that my father would read to us when we were little. We'd kind of line up beside him on the sofa and he would read to us. And it's
wonderful.
Called Peter and Prue. And Peter and Prue are the youngest children in their families and they feel left out and forgotten. And they're sitting on the doorstep of one of the other's houses, and it's set in England. And they both say, I want to run away from home. And some fairy godmother comes up and says, all right, I gotcha. And she takes them off and they stay with one Greco-Roman mythical character after another. And they have one
excellent
another. And as soon as I opened that up and I remember talking to you about it, I thought, oh, this is Peter and Prue in Iowa. Can you read a story for us from Being the Youngest?
Sure. There's as I was looking through my work today, I realized that there are some remembered experiences that come back in the fiction. And one of them is the death of my dog, Buster. And I have two versions of that. One of them is in Being Youngest, when Henry and Gretchen have to deal with the fact that this wonderful dog gets hit. Here it is. As they came down the last stretch to the intersection, they heard the rumbling roar of a big vehicle coming. They slowed down and moved off to the side of the road. Everything happened so fast after that. They saw the cloud of dust billowing up behind the loud roar of a gravel truck. They stood next to their bikes and watched it blustering past, but it was only a second before the truck skid for a few feet, its tandem rear wheels dragging on the packed gravel, then the whooping of the large animal churning beneath it. With that, the brake lights of the truck went off and the driver sped on. Whatever it was, the truck had hit looked as if it was floating up off the ground as the dust cleared, but it wasn't floating. It was stretched out flat across the middle of the road. "What's that?" said Gretchen. He knew what it was. It was Buster. But it couldn't be Buster. Buster never went roaming like a stray dog. Buster never did anything he wasn't supposed to do. "Looks just like Buster," he said. "But Buster don't go past the corner." "Your big dog, Buster?" said Gretchen. "That's Buster," he said. "That's Buster. He must have gone past the intersection." Henry yelled as loud as he could yell, "Buster, Buster, Buster." The dog didn't move. They scrambled out of the ditch. They ran hard. For this, for a large yellow dog with a pool of blood under his head, for what had been Buster, for a large animal with his eyes popped out, for the dizzy minute of horror, for the smell of dust, for the smell of blood on the gravel, for the sound of the gravel truck speeding on in the distance. Gretchen let out a quick groaning sob and stopped. Henry was silent. "They're going to blame me," said Henry. "Look, Buster must have gone down the ditch to see what he was hiding in the grove for the old couple." The old couple are other characters in this novel. "He must have smelled something we put there. He was checking it out." "They can't blame you," said Gretchen. She looked at him now. Henry kept looking at the dog. He bent over and lifted Buster's front paw, held it, and dropped it. "Guess we've been praying for the wrong thing," he said. He stood there. He just stood there. She watched him. Incidentally, what they're praying for are these little fake legs that hang on the front of this lamb called Sixer. There's these extra pair of legs. They've been praying to get them off. My mom was good with animals, said Henry. "I remember when Buster was a little pup. She taught him to stay away from the road." Gretchen moved close to him. "We had 12 kittens one time in North Dakota." She just moved from North Dakota. "They all died of distemper." "We used to have another dog, a little rat terrier named Skippy," said Henry. "He was Buster's little friend. Last year, he ran away and never come back." "We still got Sixer. That's the lamb I mentioned." Henry kept staring at Buster. "I wish I was a town kid," he said. "Wouldn't always have to be looking at another dead animal. Every time you turn around, there's another dead one. I hate it. I'm never going to have another one. No pets. Never." "I wish I could bring him back to you," said Gretchen. "Ain't nothing we can do," said Henry. "Dead is dead. We got to get him off the road or there's going to be an accident." He bent down to take both front paws. "I'm going to pull him off the road." Gretchen watched him pull. She bent down and took the hind legs. They dragged the dead dog off the road. They stood alongside the road and looked at what had been Buster. Gretchen looked at Henry. And when he turned away to head back towards their bicycles, she followed him a half step behind. At first, the tears just rolled down Henry's face as they walked. Then came a soft whining cry from his closed mouth. He cried through his nose. She reached for his hand, but it didn't turn towards hers. She took his wrist. She walked beside him, holding his wrist as he kept his lips pinched tight and howled through his nose. They sat down in the grass with their feet in the ditch. She put her arm around his shoulder and pulled him toward her. He put the top of his head against her cheek, leaned toward her, and wept. That's Henry and Gretchen. Do I dare to read another Death of Buster story? This one's from it. In short fiction form. It's so wonderfully different.
I go with friends to see movies, and the first thing they ask me if there's an animal in it, does the animal die? And if the animal dies, they will not come with me. So
I know. No more dead animals. Yeah.
Yes, I understand.
Called the driver. The gravel truck didn't even slow down. The youngest boy heard the whoomp, whoomp, but the dog didn't howl, didn't bark, didn't say anything. The boy had his back to the road, was across the ditch and across the fence in the pig grass doing something. He didn't even remember what, just doing something, nothing bad, nothing he would have gotten in trouble for if a grown-up had seen him. Womp, womp, and a cloud of dust, and through the dust, a yellow dog flat on the gravel road. When the boy got there on the middle of the road, he was afraid he wouldn't know what to do. Then he saw the dog's eyes were popped out. That didn't leave any guessing. That didn't leave any room for panic. The eyes said it all. Don't worry, I'm dead. Not even a dog anymore. The boy looked close, looked at those eyes hard. How they were really out there, almost an inch from the sockets, and a little drool of blood from his mouth like a small apron under the dog's nose. He looked hard at it, then nudged the stomach with his toe, bent down, lifted a hind leg and dropped it. He kicked the dog once, nothing more. And then the grief. Days later, when he wasn't crying, when the shocks in his chest didn't come at him anymore when he least expected, when he no longer got sullen to keep from crying in front of everybody, he thought about the driver. He hadn't even seen a driver, only the back of the gravel truck speeding on even faster down the road. The boy hated gravel trucks after that, the sight and sound of them. But he couldn't decide about the driver. Maybe he was somebody who would have been angry if he had stopped. Maybe someone who would have kicked him for letting a dog loose on the road where gravel trucks belong. The boy couldn't hate drivers the way he could hate gravel trucks. But he thought about that driver, the tiny hollow eyes, the hair matted and long, the arms thin, but the knuckles big and crusted from scratches and bruises, a red cold sore under his nose, a thick, raspy laugh. Too virgin.
Did you lose a pet?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, that's the, as I say, memory is a gateway to imagination. In this case, you know, the memory is very much one experience, the loss of my favorite dog ever, Buster. I just created a different world in which it happened.
Yeah, I know. I grew up in a small town. We did have electricity. We did not have a one-room school. But we did not have a vet. So you took care of your pets, and we had cats. And one of our favorite cats died of distemper. And I'll never forget, you know, we had a night vigil with each one of the children going and checking on him about every hour until he died. It's very hard. And
yeah.
And when you're out and kind of in the middle of nowhere, it's a part of life. The death of
you know, I look at young people with pets now, and we live in this condo where everybody has a dog. This is a very pet friendly condo where we live. And my grandson has a dog, a big black lab named Waldo. And I think all of the dogs here are going to die of old age.
Yes.
And I never in my childhood, never once did a pet die of old age. They all died in some terrible way.
Yes. Yes.
Usually tragically being run over by tractors, cars. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's a better world for pets.
It is a much better world for pets. So from there, I want to move to station identification.
Okay.
Everybody, go blow your nose, get your Kleenex, dry up. We're going to move on to some more positive subjects. I don't want to miss telling all of you that I am Mary Edgerton. I'm here with my guest, Jim Heinen, on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT, Houston's community radio station, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And we always like to say, because we have interviewed flight controllers from NASA, that you can get kpft.org in the internet in space. So it's everywhere. We all know that Texas is a great storytelling state. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a terrific place to learn about the art of telling. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And the next swap is January 25th. The theme will be, get ready, resolutions and new beginnings. So if you made a New Year's resolution, you have to keep it up at least until the 25th so you can tell a story about it. The swap starts at 7 p.m. and you can visit their website at houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to the swaps and for information about other upcoming events. While you're there, consider becoming a member. It's an inexpensive way to hear and tell stories and to connect with other human beings during the pandemic. Another way to get into storytelling is by joining the Texas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. You can find them at texasstorytelling.com, T-E-J-A-S, and then storytelling, just as it's spelled, no periods, .com. So there's two S's in the middle of that. And then also enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under the So What's Your Story tab. Our friends at the Mall are back at Warehouse Live in person. The second Tuesday of the month falls on January 11th. And the theme is, wait for it, goals, resolutions, New Year's Eve resolutions. So there must be something. I think we are on a resolution kick here with the new year. You'll enjoy both dazzling and moving narratives and meet some of the nicest people around. And you can submit one sentence about an experience relevant to the theme, and the host, Dusty Rhodes, will read it. And let me tell you, she gives it a good read. They're quite something. For those of you not ready to venture out, you can submit the sentence online through a link on their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston. Don't worry, you'll stay anonymous, and they'll just read your response. So put it in there. Speaking of Facebook, you can find us at So What's Your Story on Facebook. Please visit us. So yes, and please like us. You can suggest storytellers or themes on Facebook or by emailing us at swys@kpft.org. Now let's get back to some stories and poems from our guest, Jim Kynan. Jim, I'm going to make a special request here. So when you were in England, Emily was two and Jeffrey was born. I remember that. And you composed.
You have an incredible memory. You really do. Frightening, actually.
2 years old, and I had never seen met a couple who had a baby. It was quite something. And Carol was just this fantastic earth mother. That was your wife then. So you had composed a really lovely poem about a father preparing for the birth of his child. And I wondered if you could read that one for us.
Called Building a Cradle?
Yes.
For fathers? It's interesting. I was going to build a cradle. I realized how impossibly difficult it would be to build a cradle, and so I wrote a poem about it instead. The artist's cop-out.
The artist's
cradle. Building a cradle. In the fourth month, when the quickening spreads into your limbs, take a walk in the woods. Find the stump in whose open mouth a seed has taken root. Do not disturb it. In the fifth month, return to the forest. Through the confusion of things fallen or growing, find the log that lies nervously in its hollow. Coax it until it follows you home. In the sixth month, linger long with the woman. Study the grain of her skin. Let the lines of the wood and her lines become magnets in your mind, pulling toward alignment. In the seventh month, watch the hands and feet working from inside. There's the carpenter. Like an apprentice, follow those movements until they are yours. In the eighth month, hold your hand on the taut navel of the woman, then on the wood. Follow the life force in, working slowly with what tools you have. whittling, shaping with a lathe, with your fingers, with your tongue. During the ninth month, when distinctions blur between you, the woman, the stranger, and the wood, do not argue with the shape as it forms. Don't look back. Let it go. That morning you find it rocking by itself. It is finished.
So beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Really so beautiful. And you wrote that before your first child, Emily, correct?
Yeah. That's true. That was written for Emily. It's funny, as I'm looking through this book called A Suitable Church, I just turned to a page that has a poem titled Falling Out of Love. You want to tell the reason I wrote this poem?
Yes, I guess we can share some of this with our listeners. I was very much in love with someone who rented out a room in the house that you and Carol and Emily and then Jeffrey were living in. In fact, he was the one who said to me, oh, there's this wonderful couple with this little girl. And we dated. I believe this was the first time I really fell deeply in love. And he was from Italy, and he would come over and he would make pizza, and he would say, Cara Maria, let's open up a pizzeria and a broccolina. Okay.
I could interrupt here and say the pizzas were not very good.
So Italian pizzas are quite plain. And
yes,
I have to
as say, I recall,
he was making a white pizza for me because I was sick. And a white pizza has absolutely nothing but a little bit of olive oil and maybe a sprinkling of Parmesan cheese. I mean, nothing, no tomato sauce, nothing. And I was very much in love. And then it was time for him to go back to Italy. And, you know, we went through the, you know, will you come back? Will you stay? Will you call me to go to Italy with you? We went through all those things and nothing came out of it. And I remember when he left, I said to myself, it sounds very romantic in retrospect, but it was true. I said, it'll take him about a day to reach Paris. So if he changes his mind in Paris, he'll be back here in 2 days. And if 2 days pass, then I know it's not happening. So after the second day, I think I must have come to you and said, okay, it's not going to happen. I need to move on. So what did you do?
I wrote you a poem.
You wrote a poem for me. So you should
read it. It's titled Falling Out of Love.
Please read it.
Let it be like balding, not the daily loss that seems to be everywhere, clogging your drain, sticking to your comb or toothbrush, staying in bed with your pillow while you rise less whole to confront the growing absence. Let it be like balding, like the moon rising through the forest, a slow ascent into the night. You find yourself alone, whole, declaring a crisp October sky.
And you know, I've had the chance to read it again a few times, and it is quite inspiring to say, I'm me, I'm here, I'm okay, and here's my world to start again. It really is a wonderful poem. And you wrote it, you read it to me, and then years later, I was living in Manhattan, and I was wandering around St. Mark's Bookstore, which is on the Lower East Side, and I found A Suitable Church, published by Jim Heinen, and I'm flipping through it.
And there you were.
Yes. And I say to everybody, this poem was written for me. I have to know this book. So the book sits with the books you signed for me, because it also has the poem written.
Okay.
In a special place. That was a special time. That was a special time.
And indeed.
I'm happy you found happiness. You've been married for, you told me, over 30 years now.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I found, as we say in Iowa, a keeper.
Very good, very good.
A wonderful woman, a wonderful, generous woman who gives much to me and gives much to the community, gives much to her friends. I keep thinking what gives Sally joy, what gives Sally joy is giving. And the second thing that gives her joy is getting thank you notes for the gifts.
Oh, I should send you a thank you note for helping us. It won't happen because she did help us. I'm going to go back a little bit in time, though, because I've had you go back to some of the older poems that I knew when I first met you and have special meaning. I knew Emily. I knew When I Fell Out of Love. But I want to talk a little bit about some of your more recent work. You write about the boys, and I think you have a very recent book called The Youngest Boy. Can you bring us up to where you are in your writing?
Well, The Youngest Boy is in print. This little story called Damaged People.
Oh, yes, yes, we're there.
The grown-ups didn't say, don't do this. Or don't do that. They just pointed at people who must have done something wrong. They pointed at the man with the missing hand who had tried to push a cornstalk into the whirring rollers of a corn picker. They pointed at the limping boy who had proven that he could jump from the 14th step of the ladder. They pointed at the man with a fingernail that was the color of the blood pushing up beneath it. That was the man who was always hammering something. He must have missed the nail. They even pointed at the boy with a glass eye who had leaned close to the sparkling welder without any goggles on. It was a pity what had happened to all those people. And the youngest boy did look at them when the grown-ups pointed them out. What he needed to do was figure out how to do what those people had done without getting all that damage. I rather love that one.
Oh, I do. You know, my mother told us that her uncle told her this story. I swear it's not true, but she swore it was true. And he was, there was a loose board on the porch. And he would bounce on it and bounce up and down barefoot, bounce up and down barefoot. And his mother kept telling him, you're going to lose your toe that way. Toe's going to get caught. You're going to lose your toe. And he lost his toe. And ever after that, when she told us, don't do this and don't do that, we were like, you remember, Uncle Joe lost his toe. It happens. And another one.
Anyhow, I gave a whole book to the youngest boy.
And you were the youngest boy, weren't you?
I was, and I wrote that novel called Being Youngest. And, is it because the youngest is picked on? I don't think so. We may be picked on by older kids and by older siblings, but I think we quite often are our mother's or father's pet. And, my mother made sure that I learned to play piano. And when I started writing, she encouraged it, so that I wouldn't be somebody who would always be coming from the fields exhausted, that I could find another way. Part of it was that she said to my dad, I thought that I had totally determined on my own to become a writer. But then my mother told me the story. She said, when you were a little boy and the Depression was over, and I looked at your dad, my father's name was Hilbert, I said, Hilbert, we're not desperate for money anymore. Let's let this one become anything he wants to be. And I thought, they decided that I would lead the life of becoming a writer instead of a farmer. They had a big hand in determining my quite delicious future.
That's a beautiful story.
I know. I learned it, many years later. Parents were actually having more to do with my freedom than I realized. They had decided that I would be able to be a writer instead of a farmer.
And it says something about the times. I know the Depression affected my parents so much, my father especially. And sometimes I try to connect back with that. But this connection for you is your mother saying, our children now have freedom that we haven't
had. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's a beautiful state.
And then there were, of course, I suspect everyone who becomes an artist or probably anything, there's a very special teacher somewhere back there, you know? And I had Miss Ten Harmsel, this tall, single woman, never married, did nothing but teach. And actually, I ended up teaching with her at one point in my life when I became a college professor, and we were colleagues. And she had been such a powerful, powerful influence on me when she taught me in Hall Western Christian High School. She'd walk into the classroom, flip the book open and say, we have a lot to get done today. And then she'd, you know, just business, get it along. But we got to talking about our personal lives. And, you know, she said, my entire life, I have never had a romantic interest in anybody, male or female. She was truly something else. You know, she did not have any desire for romance with another human being. She gave her life to the life of the mind and soul, music. She was a great musician, and she was a powerful, powerful influence in my life. Miss Ten Harmsel.
That is remarkable. You know, when I met you, I was a graduate student in biophysics. And then I decided after that, after several years, to go to medical school. And I remember going to talk to people at the medical school who were also science, some being scientists, to say, do you think I'm doing the right thing? And one of them said to me, if you want to help the world, if you really want to help the world, why are you in this rowboat rowing after the Titanic saying, wait for me, because the medical professor is going downhill. He said, why don't you become a teacher? And I do teach in my profession, but it's made me really respect the profession of teaching, because that's really how our society continues. We teach through our stories that we're telling now. We teach through our teachers who teach us our history and so on. It really is a wonderful profession. And just to add to that, I had a very brilliant friend as an undergraduate who died very suddenly in his mid-20s, unexpectedly. And he used to love to teach. He used to tutor people and teach people. And he was buried... Ken Askins, he was buried in a cemetery in Austin. And it's a cemetery that doesn't allow things to be written about the people. They're just their name, date of birth, and date of death. But his family asked if they could just put the one word underneath his name and his lifespan, teacher, because that had been
wonderful, wonderful. Yes, teaching has been a big part of my life. And, you know, I ended up teaching teachers too, teaching workshops. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting the questions after many years of teaching. They asked me after many years of teaching, what do you think you've learned? Well, the answer was quite simple. I mean, when I started out as a teacher, I was this gesticulating performer, you know, wanting all of the attention. You know, I had all of these opening jokes. I would walk into the room and in a very lavish manner, I'd say, okay, how many of you are introverts? and some of them would get it and they'd start cackling and they'd know that this was going to be a comic teacher. And so I went with the performance mode for a long time. But over the years, what became more and more important, I realized, to be a better teacher, you need to be a better listener. Mm. You really need to listen. You know, it's easy enough to perform, but to read a classroom, and I mean, if you look closely, you are listening. You're listening to the faces. You're listening to the expressions. And that probably is what I learned in the progress of teaching, more than anything else, was to become a better and better listener.
That's amazing, because you are such a great storyteller. I could listen to you forever.
Oh, tell me more about that.
We are coming to the end of their time. I don't know if there's any one last thing you want to add.
No, this has been a lot of fun. And hello to Houston. I hope your temperatures are a little more comfy than ours.
Well, you know, it went from 75 degrees and humid and miserable. And I was bringing in my potted plants because about 3 or 4 hours later, it was expected to be 32 degrees and feel like 27. And I was like, why am I sweating in this heat? Why am I even doing this? So we've had one of those experiences where Texans say, hey, if you don't like the weather, stick around because it'll change.
Yeah. And, but that joke goes everywhere.
Yes. It'll be back.
Here too. Here too. Anyhow, I wish you all the best. It's been great fun being here.
Yes, it's been so good to reconnect with you. Larry Thompson will be at the helm next week with more tellers and new journeys. But don't leave. Stay tuned in to KPFT because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with just a soothing mix of soul. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the commute whiz by. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Jim, I picked some special closing music. Stand By Me. Used by that wonderful 1986 Boys Coming of Age movie with River Phoenix of the same name, although it's the classic Stand By Me.
Thank you.
I just feel it brings the boys to mind. So it's Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, like falling out of love, it's never too late to see that moon rise over the October sky and live happily ever after. Peace.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, if the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now. Stand by me. Stand by me. by me, stand by me. Whenever you're in trouble, won't you stand by me? Oh, stand by me. Whoa, stand
by me. And folks, one last thing. Stand with KPFT. Go to kpft.org, and if you loved this show, keep it on the air. Donate and choose So What's Your Story as your favorite radio program that you're donating for. Don't forget us. Stand with us.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now, stand by me, stand by me. Stand by me, whenever you're in trouble, won't you stand by me? Oh, stand by me. Whoa, stand by. Oh,
stand. This is DJ Tom Albright coming at you with the Jazz Latino HD show every Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. with Latin Jazz and Jazz Latin, followed by an hour of hot salsa dura made for your dancing shoes from 6 to 7 p.m. every Tuesday. And if that's not enough, the Jazz Latino HD show is repeated every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. All that on Houston's community station, KPFT HD2, the veritably vital virtual radio source via the electron waves on the internet. Just go to kpft.org and scroll down. On the right side is the button to listen to HD2, or go to archive.kpft.org to listen anytime, 24/7.
Pacifica Radio is doing what it does best.
And the rich white companies are jumping the line so they can get access to the vaccine.
Covering the global pandemic.
I think people need to wake up and recognize that this is a fight against slavery.
The working class movement against racism and imperialism.
If we have a First Amendment, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere.
And holding politicians and corporate media accountable to the people. This and much more on COVID, race, and democracy. Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on KPFT.
You're